TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI. Trust-based relational intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello and welcome to the TBRI podcast. You're listening to Season 7, Episode 6. On this show, we talk all about TBRI, or Trust-Based Relational Intervention. We talk about different elements of the model itself, and also about how TBRI is applied in various communities of care and practice. I'm Emily Pickett, producer of the podcast, and I have the pleasure of introducing this episode. Today, we get to hear from one of our most popular guests to date. Marty Smith is an occupational therapist, a TBRI practitioner, a fellow of the Child Trauma Academy, author of The Connected Therapist, and as you'll hear, author of a brand new book that releases in March 2024. Marty is a longtime friend of the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development, and she is an incredible resource for approaching sensory challenges in a connected, trauma-informed way. We first had Marty on the podcast back in Season 2, Episode 3, so if you haven't heard that episode, that is one to go back and listen to. Today, we got to chat with Marty about a topic that we've recently gotten lots of questions about, interoception. In this episode, we break down what interoception is, why it's important, and how we can discern whether or not our kids may be struggling in this area. This episode is definitely a note taker, and we'll also provide lots of links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and please enjoy this conversation with Sarah Mercado and Marty Smith.
Yay, Marty. I'm so glad you're back. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Sarah. Good to see
you. I didn't realize it had been so long since you've been with us on the podcast. You've released a book since then. You've been very busy. I have to tell you, we give away your book, you know, at our practitioner trainings. And so I was like showing it to the people. We do this beach ball thing where they, you know, hit the ball around. And when I held it up and explained it, they were all like, I want it. Like, they were so excited. So it's so fun. So you're a well-known name amongst the practitioners and the people trying to become practitioners. So today,
Fun fact, I have a new book coming out hopefully next spring. So
I know.
I just finished it up. I'm waiting on the foreword. It's the last puzzle piece. So
Well, I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. It's more activity based. It's like strategies and kind of using the neurosequential model, going through the different brain areas and what activities speak to the different areas.
Oh, so, wow. What's it gonna be called?
They've changed the name on me a couple times, but it's something like the Connective Therapist Strategies for Trauma-Informed Care or something like that.
Okay.
Strategies from the Connected Therapist. I don't know.
Okay. For our listeners, when that book is released, we'll make sure that it lands in these show notes to make sure they could connect to it, or they could probably search on Amazon. I'm assuming it'll be on Amazon and find it near The Connected Therapist, your other book.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's so exciting.
It's an actual publisher too. So it'll be JKP is publishing.
Okay.
I know it'll be on Amazon, but it'll actually be in like Barnes & Noble and stuff too, which is so crazy.
Listen to you.
That's fun.
Stop it.
I know. That's the newest update, I guess.
Okay. Well, that's really exciting. That's much more exciting to me than that time you threw me in Lycra. So
it was exciting for me. That's still the highlights of my career there.
Yes, I'm thankful I could provide you with that. All right, let's dig in. So hot topic in the sensory world, which you have explained to me is a recent sort of discovery. And by recent, we mean within 10 years, we're learning about this. And, you know, Dr. Purvis used to always say, like, it takes, you know, 15 to 25 years to get new research out, which means we're chronically behind what we're learning. Interoception.
Yes.
What is it?
What is it? So I will say, and I'm going to link for you, there are several OTs that are doing a lot with interoception. Okay. And so I'm definitely going to, in the show notes, be pointing people to Tracy Stackhouse. She does a podcast called Spirited Conversations, where she addresses this and does an excellent job. Kelly Mahler is someone that is well known in the OT world that speaks, and that's like one of her main things is interoception. She does a lot of wonderful work, but interoception is where she's really highlighted in our field. And then also Amy Harris Lewis and her colleague Heather Spann have also created a curriculum called Powerfully You that I use a lot. And it is just a curriculum that kind of leads you through guiding them on self-awareness and interoception and co-regulation and, you know, eventually that self-regulation. And so it's kind of a regulatory program that is available online.
That's cool.
Amazing. So there are so many resources now that, you know, I would not consider myself the front-running expert on interoception, but a lot of us OTs, that is an area where we work. And so I'm comfortable talking about it. I'm happy to talk about it. But if anybody wants to dive deep, 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 then I want to point you to my colleagues that are really focusing on that. You know, kind of where I went to trauma, you know, they went to these other areas.
Yeah. I think it's like one of the gifts you give us, Marty. And I think so many professionals like is to be able to say like, this isn't my top area of expertise. I'll share what I know, but here's some other things. And I think like that is a real gift to have the freedom within who you are to be able to say like, let me point you to these other people. So we'll make sure it ends up in the show notes. And thank you for that. I'm excited to look those up and listen to that podcast while I'm walking.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'll say, you know, just as a surface, you know, and that's kind of what I feel like a lot of these podcasts are, is just introducing people to concepts. And I love to be the one, you know, I joke that I am the connected therapist, right? So I want to connect your listeners to, oh, I've never heard of this before. Well, this is kind of in a nutshell what it is. And then here's places you can learn more if you want to dive more. But the reality is a lot of people don't need to know all the ins and outs and all the details. They just know that in general, interoception is our sense of being and feeling. And so the way I kind of describe that is we have our senses that are I call them the kindergarten senses. We learned about them in kindergarten, those of us that are over the ages of 30 and 40. And that's sight, touch, smell, hearing, taste, you know, those kinds of things. But you also have the vestibular sense, the proprioceptive sense. The vestibular sense is your sense of movement. And it's tied kind of in the inner ear. And it has to do with how your head is positioned against gravity and how that pulls in the different reflexes. And, and it gives you like automatic movements based on, you know, kind of keeping your balance and keeping yourself, you know, in equilibrium, really, with your vestibular sense. And then the proprioceptive sense is where you are in space and where you are in relation to other objects. So, you know, being able to close my eyes and know that my hands are together, being able to not have to see the hallway or touch the hallway to be able to walk down the hallway, or be able to walk in a line without having to touch the person before in front of me or behind me. Like proprioception is kind of how we know where we are in space. And then interoception is kind of that, you know, we call them the hidden senses because we don't see them like we do taste. And, you know, taste your tongue and, you know, the eyes, you visually, you see your eyes. But interoception has more to do with how your body interprets sensations that are not necessarily conscious all the time. They can be conscious, but they don't have to be conscious. And it's how we kind of stay in homeostasis. And so, when we look at regulation as a word of our body either activating or deactivating or moving towards safety or moving, you know, away from threat or moving towards something exciting, the way we decide how we're going to move towards or away from something is how it feels in our body in regards to safety. And that homeostasis I talk about, you know, like if we're hot, then we're going to sweat so that we keep a normal body temperature. If we are hungry, then we might salivate to cue ourselves to go eat. And then that would satiate our hungry because the body just wants to be just in a state of homeostasis. And when we get prepared for fight or flight, the body has to do something to make that happen. So the heart rate has to increase, our, you know, the pupils will dilate, and, you know, we might sweat, or we might lose our bowels to make ourselves, you know, not have to worry about that. Or we won't get hungry. We might get nauseous. All of those feelings and those body actions is our interoception kind of spearheading all of that for us. So interoception is the way that our body knows what to do in order to keep us safe. And so it's both those inside feelings of, am I hungry? Do I need to use the bathroom? What is my heart rate? How are my kidneys functioning right now? Do I feel full? Do I feel like, you know, I'm in threat? And then it's also, mm-hmm. what makes it so interesting is interoception also refers to our emotions that are sometimes tied to those inner feelings. And so it's the, I'm anxious. Like, I can feel my heart rate expanding. I can mm-hmm. feel my hands sweating. And because I can tie those two interoceptive sensations mm-hmm. into a language of anxiousness, then I can label that feeling. Or I have butterflies in my tummy and my mouth is salivating. And, you know, I know that my favorite dessert is about to come out of the oven, and, you know, I'm feeling hungry. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm excited, you know, or maybe anticipating something. Or the, you know, this texture feels really good. My heart rate has slowed down because I'm very comfortable. I'm under the weighted blanket. My proprioceptive sense is sending signals to my brain about how my body is feeling, you know, squished. And I'm tying all that together with my interoception to say, I feel calm. I feel content. And so when we talk about interoception, it's really, it seems complex because it can be, because we often don't see it happening. And often, especially in our culture here in the US, we don't always pay attention to our interoception. And that's the, you know, we eat when we're not hungry. Mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. We don't eat because we don't feel hunger because we're too stressed. Or, you know, we're not sleeping well. And like, we know we're tired, but our body's internal sensations won't cue all the actions that need to happen for us to actually go to sleep. And so there's this mismatch between the body trying to maintain that homeostasis and then the words that we're using for it. Or, you know, are you tired? No, I'm not tired, you know, because I just drank a bunch of caffeine. And so we just caffeinated our system, where our interoception was trying to say, hey, we were really tired. And then we chemically, you know, stimulated ourselves so that now tired is cranky. Because yeah. The jitters, you know,
right.
And so it really, it becomes really tricky. And especially for our kids that are being told, oh, you're fine. That's not a big deal. You know, they think that they're hurt. And so their body is going into a stress response of, you know, I hit, you know, I fell, or I fell into someone, and that felt like a really big deal to me, but all my caregivers were saying it wasn't. So now I don't know how to interpret my internal sensations to know, you know. And if we weren't fed, like say we came from an orphanage or something that, you know, food was very regimented, or it was scarce, you know, or we had an adverse experience early in life where food was scarce, then we never really associated being fed with being hungry and knowing that those sensations are okay. And so what happens is our interoceptive sense says hunger is always scary, you know, or hunger is always not noticed because nothing ever happens anyway. So just don't even worry about being hungry.
Okay, this is tricky.
Yeah.
This is tricky because, like, it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like for our interoceptive sense to be developed properly, there are a whole lot of different dynamics in that, including caregiver-child relationship.
Absolutely. And attunement as well. And that's what, you know, you hear Dr. Purvis in the videos and stuff that you all share, that you call them some animation, or something, mm-hmm. you call it something. But she talks about, in the beginning, I regulate all.
Right.
And so the caregiver is attuned to the child's needs. And the caregiver really is sending those signals to help the child interpret that. Like, oh my goodness, you're cold. I'm going to put some blankets on you. Mm-hmm. You are crying. So maybe you're in pain and I'm going to try and take that pain away from you. You're crying. Maybe you're hungry. I'm going to feed you. And the caregiver really does provide that language as they're feeding the child, like, oh, yummy, yummy, yummy. You know, you act when the child says, I want more and feed me more, and they're grabbing the spoon. And then the caregiver interprets those clues and those cues from the child as, oh, you really like strawberries, or you really like this avocado or banana, or, you know, you're throwing the spinach on the floor, you know, oh, you don't like spinach, you know. So we're giving words to the child. And when we are attuned to each other, that works really, really well. But what happens when we're not attuned to one another, or you've got a caregiver that loves spinach and just is determined that her child's going to love spinach, and she's like, oh, yummy, yummy spinach, yummy, yummy, num, num, num. And the child's interception is like, I really don't think I do like this. But then they learn, well, I can't really trust what my inside is telling me because your words are different. And so absolutely, if you don't have an attuned caregiver that really respects the child's cues and reads those without projecting our own desires on them, you know,
it's so hard. And we are not going to dive into this, but I just have to say my brain is on fire to understand how attachment styles would impact interoception development. Because, like, if you think about how often, and, you know, I've been, you know, very transparent on our podcast that, you know, I come from a dismissive attachment style. I didn't learn about attachment until my children were old enough for them theirs to be formed. They therefore also have this. So how many times did I say that didn't hurt that bad, or there's no big scrape, or you don't really need a Band-Aid, right? Like,
and that's why now, you and I get along so well. I wrote a book about it, right? Like, my my first book is the whole being dismissive of my kids' experiences. And guess what? You know, one of the things that we still work on in my house is interoception.
So if we're looking through that lens, mm-hmm. and I were to recognize, like, oh, maybe my kids don't recognize some of these cues that, or they have confusion because something does hurt, but they've been trained to not feel that pain. Although, you know, we've been working hard for many years, but we're still working. What's something I can do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, know that it's way more complex than only the caregiver being involved.
Right.
I just want to name that so that one feels like they're responsible for everything that their child is going through. And then also just recognizing that we do have, you know, people who have neurodivergent, you know, like a neurodiverse nervous system, mm-hmm. right? Like, they interpret things differently. And even the most attuned caregiver may not fully understand, which is why it's so important to listen to the communities and, you know, the adults in the communities that can tell us how they do feel and how they felt mismatched and all that. So,
Then I want to back up before we get into my question and just say, how do I know? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, right, we are teaching our families and we're hoping that we're being in tune to the needs of our kids. And, you know, sometimes I think we give them so many things to do. But is there something, if I'm watching my child, and is there something that would tell me this skill is not, or this is not developed, not this skill, but their interception is not developed well? Yeah. What am I looking for?
Some of the things that you're going to look for are going to be, they can't identify their feelings ever. And they're always one feeling, you know, I'm always happy, you know, like they don't have any negative feelings at all when you're like, how do you feel today? Always happy, you know, or, they're always angry, or they just don't have the language for the feelings that they have. Also, you might have issues with toileting and feeding, that input and output of the food. Because, you know, they don't, you offer them food and they say that they're not hungry, or they don't accept the food. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, they're ravished, you know, so they were hungry. They just didn't know that they were hungry that moment. And then also, like, they may hold their bowels, you know, so then they have constipation. And something that's interesting, you know, and I don't know how much detail to get into, but a lot of kids that will hold their bowels, then it actually leaks out around, you know, like you get the mass in the middle of the colon, and then it's almost like diarrhea comes around the outsides. And so they do have soiling in their pants, you know, mm-hmm. and it's really, they're constipated. They don't have diarrhea, mm-hmm. they actually have constipation. And so, but any of those kinds of cues where their bowels are off, if they have no warnings between escalations, they're like 0 to 60, that means that they didn't notice that their palms were sweaty. They didn't notice that their heart rate was increasing. They didn't notice that some of these precursors were about to happen. They didn't notice that they were cold until they're like freezing, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, and again, there's always the age long, you know, debate of, you know, mom says you need a jacket because she's cold. You know, like right. It doesn't mean that the child doesn't know that they're cold or not, you know, but if it's really cold out and the child is not, you know, taking a jacket or whatever, then they may not feel hot or cold. Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really tricky. Is basically.
And that's why, you know, like that's why we need people like Amy and Tracy mm-hmm. and Kelly, you know, to really break this down for us a little better.
Yeah, I was sitting here thinking like, one of the things, and we talked about this last week at Practitioner, and so it's in the front of my mind. It, like, we show a video of this kid, and he's clearly, you know, in his downstairs brain, but he is a freeze, right? So he's not flighting. He's a big teenager, and at one point, the adult asks him, "Just tell me what you need. Just tell me what you need." And you can tell the adult is so desperate. Yeah. For anything to try to help this kid. And he literally, this big, sweet baby, probably 16, 17 years old, just shrugs his shoulders. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah. I really don't know what I need. And so we're unpacking the, you know, the whole idea of having to be, you know, a detective. And this yeah. is just another supporting layer of that. Like, our kids actually don't know when they're hungry. So if they say they're hungry, make the assumption that they are truly hungry and let's provide a snack. Right. So because they may have missed it until meltdown. Yeah. So, well,
and that's so important, you know, when our kids say that they're hot, you know, even if you're freezing, listen to them. And, mm-hmm. and what I find so interesting when you do these interoceptive programs and you do, you know, some of the things that people have developed, it's real interesting because one of the things you're supposed to do is just never bring your feelings to it mm-hmm. and try and be as authentic to their experience as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was really hard because I am dismissive, right? And so a typical session when I'm working on interoception in the clinic is I will have like a bucket of warm water, you know, hot, but not scalding. Obviously, I don't want to hurt anybody. And then I will have literally ice, a bucket of ice in the other water. Or the other thing. And I'll have a child put their hand in the hot water and I'll just ask them, you know, does that feel hot or cold? And so often they will put their hand in the hot water and they'll tell me it feels cold. And I, every being in me wants to correct them.
Right.
And be like, no, that's the hot water. Right. But instead we're supposed to say things like, that's really interesting. That feels hot to you, you know, and just validating, and not necessarily validating doesn't mean agreeing with mm-hmm. validating is just restating what they have already told you, and it's mm-hmm. letting them know that they're being heard. And 9 times out of 10, if I don't correct them and then I say, okay, now let's put our hand in this bucket of ice, then they'll put their hand in there, and then it's like you can see the synapses firing and they're like, oh, that is cold. And it's like, oh, that feels cold, you know, and then I might step back and say, which one felt more cold, you know, and they're like, well, definitely ice, right? And then the next week we might do the exact same thing. And it's fascinating to me that they will then know that this is hot water. Mm-hmm. But if I have gone, and especially kids with trauma, especially kids that have high shame and high expectation that they're always wrong, I, you know, if I were to correct them and be like, no, that's the hot water, this is the cold water, feel this one and feel the difference, and make it about my language and not theirs, they'll sometimes double down on me mm-hmm. and they'll insist that the hot is cold. Right. And well, then yeah. it becomes kind of a power play. But if I just sat back if I'm patient, and that's my advice to our parents, is when your child is telling you things and everything in your being is like, that's not reality. Like, mm-hmm. how can you possibly, you know, and even, you know, you're not hurt. I don't see the blood. You know, there's no need to call 911, you know, those kinds of things. If we just kind of set back and say, you really hurt, this seems really big to you, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. just validate it, then they will self-correct. And that's my encouragement to your listeners, is that if we just reflect, they do sort it out themselves. And it's yeah. really fascinating to see happen.
Yeah, it's fascinating because one of the beginning parts of my TBRI journey and trying to be less dismissive was to acknowledge pain when my children would bring their pain. And right, if you've been a parent for long enough, then you know sometimes, you know, owies come to you and there is zero evidence to support that something actually hurts. And it was a step in my mind of saying, maybe they just need you. Right. And so maybe you just need to show up for them. And we started blazing through Band-Aids in our house because all of a sudden, like, I'm acknowledging their pain.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for me, it was all of a sudden a moment to go like, oh, like, turns out I can just sit with you for literally like 30 seconds to a minute, give you just some of that, you know, proprioceptive touch. We'd put the Band-Aid on, I'd kind of push it onto their hand. We get some eye contact. We connect for a minute. I'd tell them, I'm so sorry for your hurt. Even though, here's the truth, in the back of my head, I'm like, this don't hurt. There's nothing here hurting you. Right. Like, but for them, it was like connection with their mom. Right. And so just being willing to take that 30 seconds to a minute, it ended it because they had their need was met. Yeah. Right. And then all of a sudden those types of instances started to diminish.
Yeah.
Until I would notice I became less available. Right. Yeah. So if I started to become really distracted, or if I didn't make the time to connect with them like I needed to every day, then all of a sudden those incidents would pop back up. And as soon as we could like get into a good pattern, the times when they were truly hurt or truly like needed some level of intervention became very, very clear to me. But we would even take trips to the doctor because I'd be like, well, they're still complaining about this. And, you know, the doctor's like, I mean, there's really nothing, but what the need was actually me.
Yeah. Well, and what's fascinating with that too, and Bessel van der Kolk, this is another thing you could link in your in the notes, is, you know, he wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. Mm-hmm. And one of the premises is in that, and he talks about interoception and how it's like the mohawk of awareness. So the structures in the brain, the prefrontal cortex and the medial and the orbital cortex, or the cingulates and the, the insula, the insular cortex as well. Like all of these internal structures, you know, when they light up and when they, when you're having trouble with the interoception, then sometimes you actually moves into physical things, right? Mm. And so like, even though you had like an emotional hurt, it will come out as a physical mm-hmm. symptom. And mm-hmm. even chronic pain and chronic illnesses and the fibromyalgia and, you know, so many of these inflammatory things. And even the ACEs study showed us like psychological mm-hmm. things and feeling yep. things can come out in very physical ways. And so mm-hmm. even though we're looking at the situation and we're saying, I see nothing physically wrong with you, sometimes it's easier to bring a physical, you know, expression of our internal emotions. And that is that interoception. And it's that not being able to tie the two. And so then you're relying almost exclusively on those external physical cues mm-hmm. and to where the body actually does do. We do, you know, we increase our cortisol, we increase some of the stress hormones. And then like the body literally will move into physical things mm-hmm. when we don't acknowledge that internal interoception. And I love the idea when we're working on interoception, you noticed maybe that when I gave the example of when I was treating it, I'm working on physical hot and cold. Mm-hmm. Like that is a very subjective outside of the body thing. And so when we work with interoception, we're going to work on, you know, muscles, squeezing the muscles and things that we can really impact and see and control, if you will, you know, because I can't look at a child and be like, okay, you know, let's make your kidneys secrete some hormone
Right.
And we'll see if you need to pee. You know, like, I can't do that, but I can, you know, put a soft blanket on them. And then, you know, soft versus scratchy. I can do hard versus soft. I can do, and it's so fascinating to me, these kids that have poor interception, you know, I'll give them a super soft, fuzzy rabbit. And they'll be like, he feels really rough. You know, and I'll be like, well, let's go touch a goat, you know, who has actually rough hair, right? Or the llama or something. And they're like, oh, he's so soft. And it's like, it doesn't match, right?
Right.
But we work on those external senses first, and then it becomes internal. So when your child is coming to you with their external feelings of pain and hurt and owie, that could be sadness. And, you know, rejection or fear, you know, because guess what happens when you have a pain response, your heart rate might go up and you might get warm to the touch, your temperature might increase, you know, like, and those same symptoms come about with some of these physical ailments too. And so when they come to you and you don't see any physical evidence, then the cue should be, maybe this is an internal feeling that they just don't know how to identify yet. But as I provide comfort to them, you know, then they can, they then can move into that cortex. And really, when we think about the prefrontal cortex being that awareness of our interoceptive abilities, we have to have that online, you know, and that's that upstairs brain, downstairs brain, flipping your lid kind of stuff that you guys talk about. You know, if you flip your lid, you don't have access to the parts of your brain that deal with interoception.
Right.
So, so it's really important to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you. I get excited. If this is developed, like, just, you know, optimally, when is it fully developed?
I don't know the answer to that. I would have to look it up. I'm going to take a guess because I like to guess at things. But this is where, you know, Kelly might be able to give you an actual answer. I would say like 25.
Okay, that's what I was thinking when you said.
And the reason I'm going to say that is because if it's the prefrontal cortex that's really mediating it.
That's what I was thinking.
Then it's not developed until 25.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why little kids especially have no clue how they feel. And that's why little kids don't understand the nuances of emotions. You know, everything is happy or sad or mad, or, you know, like, they're very basic emotions that they have or that they express. They have all the emotions, you know.
Right. We were talking last week about how funny it was that now, you know, at the ages we are, I think we were sitting around the table. There were probably some staff and mentors. I can't remember how, like, we're just now figuring out, like, oh, like, I need some protein right now, right? Like, the ship's about to crash and I need some protein if I'm going to stay above water, or like, I'm really dehydrated today. I'm beginning to get a headache. I can feel it in my body, right? Like, that even after, you know, I'm a spry 50 year old now. So like, it's like at 50 and it's been a few years of this, but like, it's almost like you have to be in conversation to even understand that you need to be in touch with your body and understand its needs that impact every other thing you do. Right.
Well, so it's how many people brought awareness to you that a headache could mean dehydration?
Right. Very, very few. Yeah. At least, I mean, in my growing up, it was like, you know, we joke around now about this generation and they're like water bottles that are like their security blankets. But I'm thinking, how much better would we have been if we had been carrying water bottles all the time, right? Like, because these kids are actually hydrated and they drink water. Like, we drank Kool-Aid and all kinds of junk all the time, you know?
We just drank it straight from the garden hose. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because we weren't allowed back in the house.
And so, yeah, but, you know, just thinking about that and bringing in that social awareness of, you had someone say, oh, you might have a headache and that might mean dehydration. And so then you experimented with that.
Right.
It wasn't the first time someone said, oh, you have a headache, you're dehydrated. And every time you get a headache does not mean that always it's dehydration. It could be an illness. It could be fighting. Yeah. And so that's what interoception is so tricky, because there are so many things that could mean other things, you know, like headache doesn't always mean the same thing. And so we have to know how to be in tune to other systems as well. And it's really that complexity of so many, you know, and then we get into the polyvagal theory, right? And the many organs that go in through that vagus nerve, and how you're really assessing heart rate and lungs. They tie together, you know, like so all this. Yeah.
If I'm a parent listening to this, which I am, and in the conversation, and I'm thinking about when my kids were little, I probably would have been crawling out of my skin right now. So, because I would have been like, how am I supposed to keep up with one more? Like, how am I supposed to monitor? How am I supposed to develop the system? Like, oh my gosh, now like another thing on my plate.
And I don't know her exact quote, but she said something to the effect of comparing humans to plants. Right. And this is where I'm gonna, you know, bundle up interoception for you. One, listen to the kid. And don't tell, don't negate their feelings. You don't have to agree with them, but validate their feelings. Number one, you know, treat them as, you know, give them respect. Mm-hmm. And then the second is that, you know, treat them like a plant, you know, make sure that they have water, make sure that they have, you know, sunshine, and, you know, move them if they're not thriving. And so like move them outside or whatever, you know? And so really, If I'm trying to like decrease the stress of the parents that are listening, make sure your kids are hydrated, make sure that they're able to move around, make sure that they're getting some sunlight, you know, and really it will take care of itself. If you're not minimizing their experiences, they will figure out their interoception, you know, if as long as you're just a sounding board for them. And that's really my call to change, is to just stop telling kids how they feel. Because we don't always know. And that's the hard thing to do. But instead, saying things in respectful ways, you know, you don't want to be teasing or mocking, or you have to watch your tone when you're saying things. But like, you know, your fists are really tight. You know, your fists are really tight and you're banging them against that table. Like, you know, and then asking, do you feel angry? And they might be like, no, I'm just catching a good rhythm, you know. I don't know, you know, but staying curious about it, I think. And if you are going to name things, name them in a very curious way. And then when the child is like, no, I'm not angry, then you just say, okay.
Right. I didn't think so, sir. It's the same with tired, right? Like a huge trigger for me is for somebody to say, you're probably just tired, because that was how I felt dismissed as a kid, right? Like I had any experience of emotion and it was like, oh, you're tired, go take a nap. Like, go, I don't like how this emotion feels to me, so you go over there and just take a nap. And when you wake, when you wake up, you'll be good enough to be with me. Because you won't be tired anymore, because tired creates this. And so like when people are like, well, maybe you're tired. I hate it. I absolutely hate when somebody says that. I can recognize it, but my experience tells me I don't like the way that feels. And so it's that thing of like, yeah, kid, you know, you know, they're tired, but how can we lead them, you know, in ways that are validating to everything else they have going on? I really like that, Marty. I really like that.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Care and Purpose Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.